Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Finances have been a stressor for many people as the pandemic caused many to be furloughed or permanently displaced from their jobs. Today on Insight, Cap Radio's race and equity reporter will dive deeper into the latest COVID-19 resiliency survey we conducted along with Valley Vision to better understand who these people are. Plus, EDD has just struggled to keep up with unemployment payments when California first shut down. More than a year later, the unemployment benefit backlog is growing once again. We'll talk to an unemployment law expert about why this is still a problem and what you can do if you're caught in this financial headache. If you have any questions, you can send them to insight@capradio.org. Later in the hour, warming weather means bee colonies are starting to grow out of their old homes and begin to search for new ones. We'll learn about why bees swarm, what to do if you actually find a swarm at your home, and best practices to keep these crucial pollinators safe. But first, Governor Gavin Newsom announced Monday his plan to give California residents another stimulus payment, this time offering it to even more people. Joining us now to give us the rundown and the timeline of this new proposed tax rebate is Cap Radio's politics reporter and California State of Mind co-host Nicole Nixon. Welcome back to Insight, Nicole.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Nicole, just starting off, I mean, last year, I mean, this is more than a 180. The state was facing a budget shortfall of about $54 billion. How did we end up with a budget surplus of $75.7 billion?
Yeah, as you know, California has a progressive tax structure, which means higher earners pay more. Well, who's done well financially over the past year? The highest earners, right? So as these people earn more, they pay more in taxes. Also, I'll just note that the Legislative Analyst's Office, the nonpartisan staff for the state legislature, they said a few months back that they actually believe the deficit last year, that $54 billion deficit, was a bit of an overcorrection. They say the state did not need to cut that deep. But, you know, a year ago, they made that estimate based off the information they had at the time. Think about where we were a year ago. Things were not looking so good.
Mm, so we rebounded and then some. So mm-hmm. The totals are just under $12 billion in relief. So what does that actually mean for individuals? How much money could people receive in this round of stimulus?
Yeah, so people who earn less than $75,000 a year would get a $600 check. And then parents with children, those who are undocumented, would also get an extra $500. So many families could be looking at $1,100 or even $1,600. And the governor's office says that two-thirds of California residents would get a check under this proposal. The one caveat here, though, is that people who already got that $600 check earlier this year, there was a first round of stimulus for lower income earners, they wouldn't be able to get a second check, though they may be eligible for that $500 bonus if they have kids.
And would that extra money, when it comes to children, is that per child or just per household?
No, it is just per household.
Undocumented immigrants would also receive some stimulus, correct?
Yes. And they would also get a $500 bonus. And Newsom says that that's because undocumented immigrants have been left out of virtually all federal relief plans. So they did not get any federal stimulus checks. And they make up a huge part of California's workforce, especially frontline workers.
Yeah, this is actually quite rare. I mean, state law does require taxpayers get a rebate when we have a budget surplus a certain size. And this is sizable, to say the least. Can you just kind of explain the state law that made this possible?
Yeah, this is a law called the GAN limit, and it actually came 1 year after Prop 13 passed. It was pushed by the same group of Republican tax activists in the late 70s, and it stipulates that if state spending goes over a certain amount, some of that has to be returned to taxpayers as a rebate. And this has only ever happened one time in the four decades that this law has been on the books. But it is looking like the state will hit that limit this year, even with a surplus this gigantic. A couple other things to note here, though. The state will not officially determine whether it needs to distribute a rebate and how much that would be until 2 years from now in 2023. So Newsom, by proposing this stimulus, this rebate right now, is trying to get out in front of that with this proposal. And it is possible, if the budget surplus continues to grow, that taxpayers would be owed even more money when we get those final numbers in 2023.
What's the next step in all of this? How do lawmakers decide whether to push this stimulus plan through or to not do so?
Yeah, this is part of their regular budget process now. You know, the governor's touring around the state giving his California comeback, you know, recovery plan, he's calling it. He'll submit his revised budget proposal at the end of this week. Lawmakers and the governor will then head into intense negotiations for the next month or so. The legislature has to pass a budget by mid-June. The governor has to sign it by the end of next month. So this is all part of this regular budget process now.
If everything clears the finish line, how long until people actually see this money?
It's a good question. I am told it could hit people's mailboxes around 4 to 8 weeks after it's approved. So that would probably be late July, maybe even into September. Mm. And it would be an actual check in the mail.
And I think as expected, Republican lawmakers are calling this a recall refund. Obviously, he is facing an all but certain recall election later this year. So what is the governor's response to all of this?
Yeah, Republicans are, you know, clearly arguing this is politically motivated because Newsom is under this recall threat. And, you know, for his part, Newsom says this is not driven by the recall, that he is genuinely trying to help people recover economically. He's also argued that this is going above and beyond what the GAN limit would require, although it does line up, you know, with the numbers we have right now, exactly with what that law would require. But, you know, look, for any politician under threat of a recall, you can't deny that giving out money is a really good strategy, yeah, as long as the state can afford it, right? Which the state clearly with a $75 billion surplus right now can.
Cap Radio's politics reporter and California State of Mind co-host Nicole Nixon, thanks for giving us the update.
Thank you.
Up next, we're going to bring on an unemployment law expert to take on the continuing issues plaguing the State Employment Development Department, or the EDD, also known as the EDD, since the start of the pandemic. Just this month, it was reported that over 1 million people still have unresolved claims with the EDD, and that's an increase from the past 2 weeks prior. Nearly 300,000 claims are pending EDD action, while the rest are awaited to be certified by claimants. According to CalMatters, many pin the blame on EDD's technical glitches, long waiting times for a call center representative. Since we've been reporting on this story here at Cap Radio, we've learned that the people are not able to speak with an agent has really just been an issue for over a year now. We're talking about people calling for hours, even using multiple phones to try and get through. Recent data from the EDD shows that for the last week of April, April 26 to May 1st, that the call center answered less than 6% of calls that came into their center. People called an average of 12 times to try and get through. Joining us now to help us navigate the issues EDD is facing is Insight regular Jennifer Shaw. She is the president of Shaw Law Group and an expert in unemployment law. Jennifer, welcome back to Insight.
Good morning, Vicki. I'm happy to be here as always.
Well, Jennifer, I know you've been talking with clients about this issue for over a year now. What are the current concerns that you're hearing from your clients?
Well, we still have a number of clients who have employees they were forced to lay off because of COVID-19 who cannot get their benefits. So the statistics that you just cited, Vicki, about folks repeatedly trying to contact the EDD, not being able to get through. Also, hundreds of thousands of claims are on hold because of what's happening internally at the EDD regarding confirming identities, making sure that payments are being sent to the appropriate people. So what we see is sort of a catch-22. On the one hand, the EDD has been criticized for paying people who are not entitled to the benefits. On the other hand, people who are entitled are not able to get through. And I think, honestly, it's a pretty desperate situation for many of our clients' employees or former employees. And then the other issue that I don't hear being talked about that I think is so important is many employers have tried to use the WorkShare program, which is a program through the EDD that eliminates the need to lay off a group of employees if you can give them reduced hours, and they will actually get more benefits than they would if they were laid off. So they have an hour reduction, but they get compensation given back to them. The problem is even with the new law that passed that was effective January 1 regarding the WorkShare program, these folks cannot get access to the program. They register, they're not getting the documentation. Their employees are not getting their pay. So it's a significant failure of the system at this point.
I mean, over the past year, we know that EDD has tried to grow in terms of staffing, asking people to come out of retirement, saying that this is an unprecedented situation of unemployment claims. But a year later, we still have these issues, and you just talked about just one of them. So is this a staffing issue? Is this operator error? I mean, what is your sense of things?
Well, I think the term unprecedented has been used so much during COVID that I think many of us are sort of immune to the idea of
it loses its meaning, right?
Yeah. But the thing is, Vicky, it is unprecedented. I don't think any of us thought that we were going to be sitting here in almost the middle of May, still in a red tier in Sacramento, not knowing, you know, exactly what's going to happen. We hear that the state is going to open up June 15th. We're not all sure what that means. So I think the reality is we can blame, but what we really need to do is problem solve. And I have seen the EDD really work hard to try to get things handled. They are begging people, like you said, to come out of retirement. But the truth is, it's like driving on a road that should have been repaved 20 years ago. And you can't do it overnight. Their infrastructure was not what it needed to be. Their computer system was not what it needed to be. They've been asking for funding. And now we end up in a situation where the system isn't working. Well, it really shouldn't be a surprise to many people because they've been asking for help and they've been needing help. Much of our infrastructure when it comes to state agencies, computer programs, software, hardware, et cetera, needs to be upgraded. And there's been this sort of deferral mentality of, we'll get to it when we get to it. Well, unfortunately, with the pandemic, the chickens have come home to roost, and it can't be fixed overnight.
Well, according to data from the EDD, the majority of pending claims are awaiting certification by the person who filed for benefits.
Yes.
What are the challenges to certify to get your benefits? What does a person need to do to certify?
Well, at the risk of oversimplifying the process, Vicky, they actually have to contact the EDD, which is darn near impossible. So whether you use the email that they have on the website or you call through multiple times on the phone, you will eventually get through. But the problem is people are taking care of their families, taking care of the elderly, trying to make sure that they keep food on the table. So it's not the type of thing where they can repeatedly call and call and call. So these claims are sitting sort of in a state of suspended animation, waiting for some confirmation. And it's hard to do. It's happening slowly. I tell our clients when they call, listen, tell your employees, keep calling, use every system available, fax, mail, phone, email, chat, you name it, you use it. And the quicker we can do that, those claims will be reduced. And I have seen, I just saw some statistics this morning, more claims are being released, which is great. And I do think everybody is doing their best at this point. I mean, let's not forget, people who work at the EDD are people too. They have their own challenges. And there's this sort of collaboration in the community where people are trying to come together, but we're hitting a brick wall at a lot of places.
A listener actually sent in this question that kind of revolves around needing to certify for benefits, but they had said that they received instructions that there was no need to reapply, but then they received a notice to certify benefits, and obviously they're running up against the same bogged up system and they can't get through. Are you hearing that as well from your clients?
Yes,
that kind of confusion.
Yeah, there is confusion, Vicky. And I think what's going on here too is that a lot of the correspondence from the EDD is auto-generated. So sometimes you'll get a notice that was generated a while back. You've taken other action in the interim. So that notice isn't really accurate anymore. But because of just the sheer volume of what is being managed, the notices aren't getting out as quickly as they need to. So a lot of times you'll get a notice that is really not valid anymore. You've already done something, or the EDD has already pushed your claim through and you don't know it at that point. So I have a number of clients who say, oh my gosh, I just got a call and this former employee got a check, retro payment, everything, had no idea it was coming. So they are trying to push things through, but I'm hearing a lot of that.
What about individuals that actually have been certified, you know, for 6 weeks and they still haven't been paid yet? And it's going on, I think one listener told us it's going on nearly 2 months.
Well, and I hate to say it, 2 months is not unusual. You know, what the EDD's website says is that it should take 3 weeks to process your claim. Now, I want to be fair here. Sometimes people accidentally put in their wrong birthday, their wrong social security number. They've moved and they didn't update their address. So it's very important when you put in these claims that you are precise, that you get all of your documentation in front of you and you do everything you can to make sure you're providing the best information. But 2 months is ridiculous, but it's not unusual.
Tax day, the deadline is coming up pretty quickly, and there was obviously an extension, but we have, you know, about a week or so. For individuals, and you touched upon this a little bit, just kind of like the rampant fraudulent claims that they're trying to get a handle on. If you're an individual who applied to receive unemployment benefits, you didn't actually receive them, how does that complicate filing for taxes this year?
Well, the good news is if you didn't receive the benefits, the EDD will not be sending information to the Franchise Tax Board saying you did get benefits. So that's the good news. So basically, you should fill out your tax form based on reality, not based on what was supposed to happen. The government is working very hard, and I've spoken to people at all of these agencies to make sure that if you didn't actually get your benefits, you're not going to get a statement that you got your benefits. And even if you get one of those statements, they have fixed it on the back end. So it's very important for you to complete your tax returns based on the reality of you got payments or you didn't. I'm also getting advice from some tax folks and tax laws out of my bailiwick, but they are telling me that it's also important if you're going to submit your tax return in the mail, go ahead and add a cover letter that just explains, look, I was supposed to be getting benefits. I haven't received any. I think some of that sort of advanced planning can help sort things out. And I know normally we think submitting online is the most efficient way to do it, but it may actually be better to do it by mail this time. If you need to have a cover letter, you keep a copy of everything, you submit it, you take a picture with your phone of that postage so you know it was sent in on the right time, and then you can explain a little bit more about what's going on.
And I would imagine that same advice in terms of just sticking to what reality is, what you actually received or didn't receive, that probably also applies to someone if, because of fraud, someone used their name and they didn't actually, and they were unaware that they were actually receiving benefits because it was going to someone else.
Absolutely. And I think, Vicki, that's another situation where including a little note could be very helpful, where you just say, look, I understand that somebody got benefits on my behalf. I didn't get them, so I did not write them down in this return.
What if a person received their benefits, no longer needs it, they've returned to work, and they're having trouble closing their case?
So this is a big deal because, of course, appropriately so, the EDD's focus is on processing the outstanding claims. So what I've been telling folks to do is do not cash those checks, save the checks, continue working, continue trying to close your case. And at one point, the EDD will be in touch. You'll be able to say, look, I've destroyed those checks. I did not deposit those checks, but don't do it until you hear back. Now, obviously, many of us get money on a card, right? It's not an actual paper check. Some money is direct deposited. My point is don't use the card, don't cash the check, don't use the money. I have a number of folks who have created a separate savings account where that money is directly deposited into, so they know not to spend it and they're just waiting to give it back.
Finally, I mean, we know that everything the circumstances are like a kaleidoscope, right? You can't go through each and individual circumstance. But considering just the backlog of claims, how difficult it is to get through, what would you say to someone who just kind of feels demoralized? And they're like, is it even worth it at this point to try and resolve their issue, whatever that issue may be?
So I've had a lot of conversations with folks about that, Vicki. And what I tell them is, you are entitled to this benefit. Do not give up. I know it's hard. I know it's stressful. My heart breaks for these folks who have been waiting and waiting and waiting. But don't give up. You've paid into the system. You're entitled to the benefit. So do whatever you can. Use whatever resource you can. And just what I'm finding is helpful is you set aside, you know, 30 minutes a day to work on your claim. You don't worry about it. You don't stress about it. You do what you can in those 30 minutes and you keep going. Don't give up.
Jennifer Shaw is the president of Shaw Law Group and an expert in unemployment law. Thank you for joining us on Insight.
Vicki, thanks for all you do. Be well.
You as well. Up next, our latest Cap Radio and Valley Vision COVID-19 resilience survey shows the income inequality gap has just widened since the start of the pandemic. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org, or you can use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Income inequality has been an issue for years in the state and in the nation. But a Cap Radio and Valley Vision survey found that the pandemic caused an even greater wealth gap for Black millennials. Those surveyed live in Sacramento, Yolo, El Dorado, Placer, Yuba, and Sutter counties. In our latest series of polls, around 40% of African-American respondents felt less employable a year into the pandemic, with only a quarter of white respondents feeling the same. Joining us now with her reporting on the wealth gap impacting communities of color is Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, Sarah Mises-Tan. Welcome back to Insight, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Vicki.
What did the survey show about communities of color and their employment challenges?
Yeah, I'd say the survey showed once again that people of color were shouldering the burden of economic stress from the pandemic. Most interestingly, Black respondents were this time by far and away the most likely to have said that things like their skills have made them less employable post-pandemic. At nearly 40% of respondents, this to me pointed at a level of difficulty in just finding employment again. And I know there have definitely been a lot of discussions about, you know, who will be returning to the workforce and how has the workforce changed in the pandemic. And African-American respondents were also most likely to feel that changes to their industry post-pandemic had made it much harder for them to find employment again.
When it comes to generational wealth, I mean, we know just from research that when it comes to communities of color, particularly the Black community, generational wealth is a challenge. When it comes to the survey and when you're talking to individuals, how did this tie into the idea and the challenges of generational wealth?
Of course, yeah. So, you know, I'd been speaking with some experts, and many of them had mentioned that millennials in particular have had a very difficult time building generational wealth through things. I think most typically when we think of generational wealth, we think of homes as people's main financial assets. And of course, you need a steady and stable job to be able to afford and buy a home. And for Black millennials in particular, there were a couple studies that showed that they were falling further behind than even previous generations of Black Americans when it came to this sort of progress. Here's Marilyn White. She's a financial advisor in Sacramento.
You know, when that first Great Recession hit, it set African Americans back like 50 years in terms of home ownership. So certainly millennials are a part of that. And even though many of the millennials had purchased homes, many of them lost those homes to foreclosure.
And White also says that this pandemic loss of income can ripple out past this generation. And of course, that means that this generation will be a lower homeowner. This generation has lower homeowning rates, of course, and Black Americans will feel that the most. And she said that it also can trickle into just how well-educated millennials will choose to be, and what types of businesses they can or can't start as a result of this financial loss. Here she is again.
Millennials may never, ever be able to accumulate the wealth that their parents did because, you know, to be at some of the ages that they are now, where they, some of them, you know, should be in more of their kind of prime earning years, you know, they've had this double setback. And quite frankly, they may never get to a point where they will amass the kind of fortune that some of their parents have.
And she says this loss of wealth is, of course, going to play into decisions, like I mentioned, what level of education they can obtain, careers that they and future generations will choose to pursue, and houses that, of course, they can and can't afford. You know, I spoke with a number of Black millennials this past week who had just mentioned, you know, that they were foregoing getting graduate degrees. They had planned on doing it this year, but that the pandemic had kind of offset their finances in such a way that, you know, they were rethinking that decision. And they also mentioned that losing generational wealth with their parents' generations, especially with the Great Recession, meant that sometimes they did, you know, they missed out on certain opportunities at school, or they decided to pursue certain career tracks that could make them more money versus a career track that was closer to their passion, just because they had felt like they were kind of playing catch up if their parents hadn't owned a house.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of a home mortgage, it's 30 years, and that is really the best way to pass on wealth, a home to future generations in a family. When it comes to the pandemic, especially during this time, home prices are rising. It's incredibly difficult to purchase a home. You talked to, as you mentioned, millennials that had hopes of purchasing a home and had these hopes of going to graduate school, and they had to put that on hold, or now they're reevaluating their financial path. Can you share some of those experiences with us?
Sure. Yeah. I spoke with Kayla Green. She's a 30-year-old elementary school teacher in Sacramento. She says her mother lost their childhood home during the Great Recession. And for her, she says she's basically felt like she's been playing financial catch up ever since.
My mom owned a home, and during the recession, she lost the home. So now I'm the only one who owns a home within my immediate family, like my siblings and my mother.
She does have a house, it is important to note. She was able to get one through a teacher home buying program, but she says she's the only homeowner in her extended family, and so her house ends up being kind of the gathering place and the living space for people who are going through rough times. She said during the pandemic, her siblings, her mother, and some of her nieces and nephews were all living in that house with her together. And the burden of essentially her partner and her mother losing their jobs during this pandemic, plus the fact that there were a lot more people in her home, just led to higher bills.
The fact that we had to be home and confined in the home more often, bills were higher. And I wasn't able to save money because I had to pay bills. So every time I got a check, I got three bills in the mail. Yes, the pandemic definitely halted my savings.
And, you know, she's very typical. She decided to forego getting a higher degree of education. It's something that she was looking forward to doing. She was trying to get a psychology degree, but she says she just hasn't saved that much this past year. So she's going to put that on hold for now.
When it comes to solving these challenges, and in particular, we're talking about Black millennials, what are they telling you with kind of their strategy or their hopes to try and combat this issue?
Yeah. So, you know, I think there's a glimmer of hope, or at least this interesting kind of side door that I think a lot of millennials of color that I heard in talking to them about this story have been taking. Kayla Green is included in this, where she said, you know, she found herself with more time on her hands because of the pandemic and her bills were high, and she started looking into learning how to invest. Investing was not something that she said her parents did. And it wasn't really something that she particularly had a lot of knowledge on, but she said that she started learning, just like Googling and through Instagram, actually, and just like reading about tips. And she started to get into the stock market and get into cryptocurrency. And that was a trend that I heard almost across the board with Black millennials, is that they were like, yes, we may not be able to afford a house, and maybe I'm not going to be able to afford to be able to go to school to get that higher paying job. But there's a little bit of a backdoor, which is the cryptocurrency market is booming right now. And they figured, you know, if she didn't have a ton to lose, so why not get involved? I spoke with another millennial. His name is Josh Pugh. He himself does own a home, but he said basically he also had time on his hands, and cryptocurrency is something that he hopes is his way of building that generational wealth for his children.
Purchasing a home is far to reach than it was for my parents. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's setting us back. But noticing a trend for people in my age group, we're investing a lot more. So we're turning to apps like Robinhood, taking advantage of cryptocurrencies and using that as a way to, in a hopes, catch up to what our parents once had, which is the ability to purchase more, you know, homes and other assets that they had access to back in the day when things were a little bit more accessible and affordable.
Yeah, I think, you know, Josh is really speaking to just, you know, crypto is something that I think a lot of millennials, because of, he mentioned Robinhood, it's just so accessible in a way that it hasn't been, especially if you're someone who's new to investing. I know that a couple different experts had mentioned to me that investing has never seemed more like easy to get into. You can basically tap an app, put in some money, and just hopefully watch it grow. So,
yeah, that's a really good point. You also talked to an individual, 28-year-old Tyler McClure, when I was reading your reporting. And, you know, he had the hopes of having his own nonprofit and going beyond a 9-to-5 job. But because of the past year, you know, those dreams and those hopes of having that nonprofit were put on hold, correct?
Yeah, yeah. Unfortunately, he also, you know, he had plans for 2020 that went very differently from the way things turned out. And yeah, he was saying that he wanted to create basically a business that he could then pass down to his children as his generational wealth. But he took a pay cut in his job, and he said that's essentially his nonprofit is not going to happen right now.
When you talk keep going. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, you know, Tyler is another person who did talk to me about how he's gotten into investing this year as well, and how he's finding a lot of tips on Instagram. I think it's just like, it's a trend that I've heard, and I've heard from like financial experts who have just said that like millennials in particular, and Black millennials, this is a generation that is far more invested in the stock market than even past generations. There's always been that racial gap when it comes to who is invested in the stock market. And it actually looks like Black millennials in particular are getting pretty close to the number of white millennials who are invested in the stock market. It was kind of incredible.
When you speak to those financial experts, I guess, what is their take on the situation? Is it ultimately a good thing?
Yeah, you know, I think, of course, we need to acknowledge that like crypto is something that is off the hook right now. But it is something that I think a lot of the financial experts are a little bit wary about. And of course, that does bring in this equity question of, okay, Black millennials are looking to build their generational wealth this way. It is more accessible than investing was for their parents, but it's way riskier than, say, just being able to buy your own home and building wealth in like a really stable way that way, since crypto is something that, you know, even I don't really know like what is influencing the market forces there. And so you're kind of just riding that wave. And so, of course, you know, I think there's some hope that it can kind of help this generation build the wealth that they'll need to pass over to the next generation. But it's risky.
You know, when it comes to the financial crisis, the Great Recession was, you know, 2008, and obviously has lingering effects even to now. And then we had a mini recession in the past year. You can just kind of help paint the picture of why minorities are most impacted by the financial crisis. And ultimately, what do we need to do to break that cycle?
You know, I don't have the answers in terms of what it would take to break that cycle. I do think, and I have spoken with the California Black Chamber of Commerce, and actually they've been teaching finance classes throughout the pandemic, and they've said that that finance class has just exploded for them since the pandemic started. And so I think the answer that at least the California Black Chamber of Commerce is saying is invest. Invest your money, invest it smartly, and maybe you can watch that grow a little bit and maybe make up some of the losses. Do it smart and carefully, I would say.
Sarah Mises-Tan is Cap Radio's race and equity reporter, and you can find her story on capradio.org. Thanks for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Still ahead, it's that time of year when bees start looking for a new home as they outgrow their old one. We're going to bring in an expert on what to do if you see a swarm of bees and also how to keep them healthy, given that they are such crucial pollinators to our community. You can join the conversation, too. Email us at insight@capradio.org or use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez.
Oh, no hurry, Pooh. The bees are quite gentle. As long as there's no sudden movement. Oh my. Pooh, are you sure that's a good idea?
Oh, yes, Piglet.
No!
I'm quite sure.
Well, you know best, Pooh.
Oh, there we are. Oops. No plan, Piglet. Run.
Winnie the Pooh and Piglet. Well, it is that time of year again when bees start looking for a new home as they outgrow their old one. Any outdoor activity can result in a short encounter with a bee or two while bees are out and about doing their really important job, collecting nectar and pollinating plants. Joining us now to help us learn more about bee swarms and what to do if you see one is Dr. Elena Nino. She is a UC Davis Extension Specialist for Apiculture. Elena, thank you so much for joining Insight. We're having a little bit of sound issues. All right, we're going to do a quick music break and get Dr. Elena Nino back on. As always with Zoom, there's always some little technical glitches. We'll be back in just a moment and enjoy the melodies. All right. Welcome back to Insight. We are going old school. We have Dr. Elena Nino on the phone, not on Zoom. And as I mentioned, she's a UC Davis Extension Specialist for Apiculture. Welcome to Insight.
Yes. Hi, Vicki. Sorry about that. You never know with the technology, I guess, these days. But oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah, don't worry. Don't worry about it.
As I was saying, I was chuckling at your little intro with the poo, and Piglet was absolutely right. You probably shouldn't be doing what Pooh wanted to do.
Well, I guess, can you just talk to us about what's going on in the bee world right now?
So, oh my goodness, so a lot is going on in the bee world right now. I'm sure everybody in your audience probably knows, maybe not, that the pollination, almond pollination, is the biggest event that happens really in the world in terms of pollination, and it happens here in California. It ended somewhere in late March, early April, so beekeepers have moved their bees to other crops. They moved it into queen production, a package bee production. They moved into producing honey. So bees are now back all over the country. And, you know, beekeepers are doing what they can to take care of them. They have a lot to deal with in terms of pests such as varroa mites, lots of pathogens that the poor bees have to deal with and beekeepers have to take care of. Some impact of pesticides potentially, and then poor nutrition. So,
you know, when it comes to swarming, I was reading a 2018 UC Davis report. It happens from spring to summer. Can you just explain what a swarm is?
Swarm is essentially a group of bees that have outgrown their natal nest, and they are now out with the old queen from the original nest, and they're looking for a new nesting location. Essentially, the original colony got crowded because the queen laid a lot of eggs and produced a lot of workers. And those workers now said, hey, we're a little crowded. We need more space. So they took off. And it's essentially how the colony reproduces. So from one colony, you can get two colonies or even more sometimes. So they can be additional swarms, not just one. And as I said, it's a group of workers with the queen that are now searching for a new nest. And oftentimes when I get a phone call from homeowners, they'll call me slightly in panic and say, oh no, there's a group of bees hanging out on my tree or under a canopy. What do I do? And normally what I tell them is, you know what, call me back tomorrow. If they're still there, I will walk you through what to do. But oftentimes they will just take off. They're just resting there looking, as I said, for a new nest, for a new cavity to start a new colony. And they will take off after usually a day or two. If that swarm does not leave, then you have an option of calling your local beekeepers association. Oftentimes, if you just Google California State Beekeepers Association, they have a list of local bee associations, and you can contact somebody in your vicinity. For example, for Sacramento area or Davis area, I normally say go to the Sacramento Area Beekeepers Association website, and they literally have a page dedicated to swarms and swarm removal. So you can get somebody out there to come and get your swarm.
Yeah, there are instances that, you know, a colony of bees can return multiple times in, you know, in a decade or what have you. What can make a specific place appealing to bees that, you know, a new swarm returns every few years or so?
If a swarm keeps returning to a same location, that means usually they found a cavity that works for them in terms of the size. So what they're looking for is usually a hollowed out tree. Oh my goodness, sometimes even between the walls of a house. If they come back, they will sometimes nest in a water meter, but they look for a cavity that's about 40 to 48 liters in volume. So that's a pretty good place for them. Of course, they'll look for a place there if there's food around that's accessible, easy to them. So that means a lot of wildflower plantings or crops, or even people's gardens, right? That they prefer to have some flowers around so they can have easy access to food, water, well-protected place. So with minimal openings, usually a colony will have one, sometimes up to five openings, but they prefer smaller openings or entrances, and usually just one so they can defend it easier if they need to.
I think maybe one part of all of this that people don't necessarily think of, I mean, I really didn't, is, you know, hydration. Bees need water. And so, you know, water sources are important, and especially when you're in the summer months and temperatures are pretty high. So how do you ensure that there's a water source available year round, especially because bees are so important to pollinating?
So we do recommend, obviously, to the beekeepers specifically to put out a water source next to their colonies. Oftentimes that water source should be something like a bowl, but it needs something that the bees can step onto to access that water. So something that maybe rocks inside a bowl of water, perhaps those packing peanuts that float on top. They're also pretty good for having bees being able to step on it and then drink water, and just make sure it's clean and you keep it clean. If that's, again, if you're a beekeeper, if you're trying to avoid having bees in your yard, which I do have people call me for that. I obviously promote having honeybees and other bees in your yards and supporting them the best that you can. Then remove water sources because they will find them. And if they, especially when we're getting into the drought period, they will find any little bit of water that they need. So if you have any water sources, you don't want bees in there, remove them. And that's why pools can sometimes be an issue for people.
Well, yeah, when it comes to pools, especially we're now approaching summer. I mean, we're approaching near triple digit temperatures. How can families keep bees away from pools if you're in the pool and you're enjoying it?
That's a great question that I get asked a lot, and I haven't really been able to come up with a great solution. Often we will tell people, again, if you can have, I know this sounds crazy if you already have a pool installed, but salty water keeps the bees away. For some reason, they don't, like the salt water pools don't attract them as much, seemingly. And then if you do have bees around, if you get rid of the foragers that are coming in, they will not go back into the colony and tell the other bees that there is water there. But again, you can also try and train them then to another source of water. So maybe move a source of water away from your pool, and that way your bees will still be coming, but they'll still find that pool. So that's like if you really hate getting rid of the bees completely. Having additional sources of water for them can be very helpful, and add maybe a droplet of lavender oil or something that they will be attracted to, and they can smell it.
If you're a beekeeper, if you're just someone that wants to kind of set up a bee drinking station and you don't mind having bees in your backyard and in your garden, I think it's also, is it also important to, is it this, like the water source, would it also attract mosquitoes and reproduction mosquitoes, or are these, I would think that they can, that both would be attracted to the same water source.
Absolutely. They would potentially be attracted to the same water source. So because of that, we often recommend having really low level of water in those bowls. And it's easy to, so it's essentially the sitting water. So two options. One is to have a low level of water, which you can create by putting sand in a container, right? So that's, water is just sort of sitting on top of the sand just a little bit, so there's not enough space for mosquitoes to breed. Another option is flowing water. So we'll often have soaker hoses that we use for watering the plants, and the bees will come to those soaker hoses and get the water, but the mosquitoes can reproduce in that water environment, right? There are some options.
When looking at that UC Davis report on bees back in 2018, I mean, we know that the situation is dire. At that time, in the United States, the number of managed honeybee colonies decreased by 50% since 1945. So if we want to keep bees healthy, what kind of plants do they like? What can we do?
So I'm definitely not a plant expert, but we do have a great resource through the university. It is the Haagen-Dazs Honeybee Haven, and it has a web page. So I would highly recommend you go to the web page, and there's a list of local plants or native plants that are available for providing both nectar and pollen sources to the bees. And they, a lot of them are drought tolerant, so they're really convenient for, especially here in Northern California area. And of course, anything that you can plant will help the bees. There is a lot of movement for working with the ag industry, so not just urban environments, but working with the agriculture and planting cover crops that would also help support honeybees. And of course, again, any little bit of planting that you can plant out there, put out for the bees, they'll be happy. And not just honeybees, wild bees as well. And that's what we want to do. We want to promote all of the pollinators.
Dr. Alina Nino is a UC Davis Extension Specialist for Apiculture. Thank you so much for joining Insight.
Thank you, Vicki. And if you have any additional questions, of course, as always, this is where we, this is why we're here, so we can promote the public and support the public. And California Master Beekeeper Program is a wonderful resource for everybody, too. Thank you for having me.
Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Going to catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.